Welcome to installment 353 of New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. Today, we'll look at crimes that get punished and crimes that don't. Who gets away with murder and who gets the book thrown at him? Speaking of books, this installment is titled Crime and Punishment, and I hope you'll stay tuned. It's been a quiet week in Manchester, my adopted town. But last Tuesday, things were jumping at the courthouse. My teenaged son had to be at the courthouse last Tuesday evening. Actually, it was just for a mock trial tournament for high school students. So we were surprised to find TV news reporters from a Hartford station speaking into TV cameras in front of the courthouse. Seemed a bit much for a high school debate exercise, but what do I know about TV news these days? I threw away my television set sometime back in Bill Clinton's first term. I didn't own a shotgun back then. That's how folk singer Utah Phillips disposed of his TV set. He told the story later to Amy Goodman on Democracy Now! Utah said he put a blindfold on his TV. Then he taped a last cigarette to its picture tube. Then he blasted the set to Kingdom Come with his 12-gauge shotgun. This was well before LED flat screens, keep in mind. TVs had a huge vacuum-filled glass picture tube. I imagine the TV made a most satisfying sound as the buckshot penetrated its vitals and the big picture tube imploded, sending little pieces of glass and metal flying in every direction. If you try this at home, remember, always handle firearms with great care. Keep your finger off the trigger until ready to fire. Be sure to wear appropriate eye and ear protection. Choose a backstop that will minimize ricochets. And before proceeding, check local ordinances pertaining to firearms discharge in your neighborhood. But as I said, I never shot a TV set myself. All credit goes to Utah Phillips. But I digress. To return to the story, the 5 o'clock dim witness news team was yakking away in front of the courthouse in Manchester because, it turns out, some trial of popular interest had just concluded. I think that trial is worth comparing and contrasting with some other trials in the news. Old trials, future trials, and trials that will never happen. One inevitable comparison is with the trial that will never happen in Ferguson, Missouri. As you recall, a white cop shot and killed Michael Brown. Black, unarmed, apparently neither attacking the cop nor fleeing, apparently with his hands raised in surrender. Though that last point is not entirely certain. But officials have found that there is no reason even to charge the officer who shot Brown with any crime. No reason even to have a trial. In New York City, in July, police confronted a man on a sidewalk. They accused him of selling unpackaged cigarettes, which is illegal in New York. The man's name was Eric Garner, and he was black. I just saw a video of the stop taken by a passerby. For no discernible reason, the white police officer suddenly lunged at Garner, grabbed him, and put him in what appears to be a chokehold. The New York Police Department prohibits chokeholds. The officer took Garner down to the sidewalk. Other white cops joined in, holding Garner down on a sidewalk, still apparently in a chokehold. Garner cried out, "I can't breathe," at least 11 times, as the cops choked him. He died. On December 4, the grand jury decided that there was not enough evidence of wrongdoing even to charge the cops with any crime. This happens so often it makes one's head spin, just trying to remember the names of all the victims. There was the unarmed man in Oakland, California, New Year's Day, 2009, arrested for no probable cause in a subway station. The arresting officer, a Transit Authority cop, made the unarmed man lie face down on the floor. The cop then shot the man in the back, killing him. The deceased's name was Oscar Grant III. This officer was tried and convicted of a relatively minor crime, involuntary manslaughter. He was sentenced to 2 years in prison, less time already served. Then there was the young black man stopped on a marijuana-related allegation in Jonesboro, Arkansas. Police searched him twice, handcuffed him, hands behind his back, and put him into the back seat of a police cruiser. Someone then shot a bullet through his head. The state medical examiner ruled the death a suicide. Now, this blows my mind. I couldn't remember the victim's name, so I did a Google search on shot in police car. Eventually, I found the one I was looking for. His name was Chavis Carter. Died July 29, 2012. But there's more. There was also Charles Smith, a black man in Savannah, Georgia, also shot with his hands cuffed behind his back inside a police car in September 2014. Police are investigating. March 2014, and there was Victor White III, also black, handcuffed behind his back inside a police car in Iberia Parish, Louisiana, shot and killed. The police say that White killed himself, shot himself in the back. The parish coroner found that actually White, hands cuffed behind his back, was shot from the front. The coroner ruled it a suicide anyway. He did not test White's hands to see if they had any gunpowder residue, according to reports. Durham, North Carolina, November 2013. 17-year-old Jesus Huerta, hands cuffed behind his back, and in the back seat of a police car, died of a close-range gunshot wound to the head. An investigation by the police ruled the death a suicide and cleared the arresting officers of any wrongdoing. Golly, there seems to be a rash of suicides by handcuffed young men of color inside police cars these days. Did you ever hear of a white guy committing suicide by shooting himself while handcuffed in the backseat of a police car? Okay, agents of the state get away with bloody murder over and over and over again. And so do the giant corporations. If a blue uniform is a really good get-out-of-jail-free card, an expensive gray suit is even better. December 2nd to 3rd, 2014 was the 30th anniversary of the criminal explosion at Bhopal in 1984. The culprits at Union Carbide and its subcontractor didn't get off entirely free. There were a handful of small fines and a few short prison sentences. 2014 not only marks the 30th anniversary of Bhopal, it is also the 35th anniversary of the Three Mile Island nuclear power plant snafu, and the 25th anniversary of the Exxon Valdez disaster. That latter one is rife with unpunished criminal felonies by Exxon and its partner BP. You may have heard that name before in connection with maritime disasters, BP. The one small bit of good news this month is that a federal prosecutor has just filed criminal charges against Donald Blankenship, the now-retired former CEO of the notorious and murderous coal mine company, Massey Energy. The charges are more symbolic than useful, but these days, even a whiff of justice smells pretty refreshing. We'll return to Blankenship in a minute. Now, back to the courthouse in Manchester, Connecticut. Remember that? In May of 2013, there had been a party nearby full of teenagers. Some of them were smoking marijuana. An 18-year-old girl, who had a puff or two, and four other teenagers, left the party, got into the girl's SUV, and sped off to fetch something. And I do mean sped off. In the nearby mostly rural town of South Windsor, they were driving 85 to 90 miles an hour. The car went over a big bump in Abbey Road, went flying, and smashed into a tree. Two of the four teenage passengers were killed. So that's what the big to-do at the Manchester courthouse was on December 2nd. The conclusion of the girl's trial. She pled guilty and was convicted of two counts of second-degree manslaughter with a motor vehicle and two counts of second-degree assault with a motor vehicle. One count for each passenger. Her attorney pleaded for leniency, the newspaper reports. He said, "This was someone who wanted to fit in, and under peer pressure and immaturity, made a bad decision." But the prosecutor pressed for the maximum sentence of 12 years in prison. He argued that the crash was not an accident because the girl knowingly drove the car after smoking marijuana. "She had every reason to know her behavior was wrong," said prosecutor Adam Scott. Judge Laura Baldini sentenced the girl to 8.5 years in prison, plus additional probation, mental health treatment, and substance abuse treatment. And the girl is required to speak out about the dangers of driving under the influence. That's on top of the 8.5 years. Yes, the convicted girl has a name, and it is in the public record. I'm keeping her anonymous anyway, 'cause darned if I can see any large difference between her and most other teenagers I've met. And I'm teaching 49 of them this semester. Now, clearly, the girl was immature and foolish and irresponsible, and two people died as a result. And convicting her of some crime seems reasonable. But 8.5 years in prison for causing two deaths through stupidity, but quite unintentionally? Whose crime was worse? That of the girl, or the cop who shot Michael Brown in Ferguson? Or the cop who strangled Eric Garner for selling cigarettes in New York? Or all the cops whose prisoners somehow shot themselves while handcuffed in the back seat of a police car? One of these perps is getting 8.5 years for manslaughter. All the others don't even have to face a trial. Or take Donald Blankenship, rich mine owner, famous for sneering at safety laws and laughing at citations for mine safety violations. In so doing, he killed many, many miners, including his final big haul, 29, at Big Branch Mine in West Virginia, 2010. He has just now been indicted for some of his past crimes, and we'll see if he serves more than 4 years in prison for each person he killed. More of that coming up. Here's Anne Feeney.
Heard 16 tons in the coal tattoo. In the coal field, danger is nothing new. Here's the question I'm putting to you: how much for the life of a miner? It should come as no surprise. You'll hear them spout the same old lies. Every time a miner dies, how much for the life of a miner? Somewhere far away from here, accountants will project. Actuaries speculate on causes and effect. No pesky regulations from the thieves that they elect. And auditors confirm the yield from their benign neglect. Each state sets a price for a leg that's lost. Lose an arm or an ear, there's a preset cost. When the air goes bad and there's no exhaust. Oh, how much for the life of a miner? A slap on the wrist or a paltry fine? Reversed on appeal on down the line. An act of God, the courts opine. How much for the life of a miner? Politicians posture at the mine face solemnly. Live reporters swarm like flies around the tragedy. Preachers will proclaim the Lord behaves mysteriously. And PR spokesmen orchestrate deniability. And now their widows, sons and daughters come to you and me and ask how much for the life of a miner. How much for the life of a miner?
And Feeney. So, at the end of November, a rare bit of good news emerged about the federal Justice Department. In West Virginia, a federal prosecutor finally filed criminal charges against Donald Blankenship, former CEO of Massey Energy. Massey owned coal mines and was notorious for ignoring or contesting the company's many, many citations for violating mine safety laws and regulations. We're talking about flagrant, hazardous violations, not trivia. In 2010, the Big Branch mine in West Virginia simply exploded. 29 miners were killed in the explosion and the subsequent fireball, fed by unsafe and illegal buildups of coal dust and methane gas. For this crime, the company and all of its executives have so far gotten off entirely scot-free. In its November report, the grand jury reported that several managers at the Big Branch mine had notified the company that illegal and hazardous conditions were in the mine. Not only coal dust, but methane gas buildup, and flooding, and more. But Blankenship personally ordered the managers to ignore every hazard and maximize production at the mine. He threatened to fire the managers if production dipped in the least. Coal dust is not only an explosive, but a terrible health hazard. It causes the fatal disease black lung. Autopsies of the incinerated mine workers in 2010 found that 71% of them had black lung disease. 71%. The industry average is 3.2%. All of this information courtesy of the New York Times, December 1, 2014. Blankenship retired soon after the explosion at the end of 2010. The previous year, his salary had been $18 million. On his retirement, in addition to his salary and benefits, he received severance payments of $12 million, plus $120,000 in fees for future consulting, plus undisclosed payments from five different incentive plans. Plus, he received a pension valued at $5.7 million. That adds up to at least $18 million, maybe more. That's a nice going-away present. Sure beats burning to death in a fireball, or choking to death from black lung. Incidentally, none of the newspaper reports I read thought to mention that the workers at Big Branch Mine did not have a union to protect them, which means they had nobody to protect them. Certainly not the high officials at the state of West Virginia, who were not going to let some grumbles from the rabble interfere with Don Blankenship and his campaign contributions and the profits of Massey Energy Company. Indicting Blankenship 25 years ago would have made a difference, but now it's mostly just symbolic. Blankenship is retired and living in Las Vegas. Massey Energy is now run by other people, and American mines are still the most unsafe in the developed world. Okay, there's my highly selective survey of the crime scene today, and my jaundiced eye view of who gets jailed, who gets slapped on the wrist, and who doesn't even get charged with a crime. On a quick glance, it sure looks like the state security apparatus has a license to kill at whim, especially if they're killing poor and or black people. And it looks like big corporations have a license to kill. And in so doing, they are generally protected by the government. But if you're nobody important and you kill somebody, like the girl in South Windsor, justice requires some serious jail time for you. All right, maybe you knew this all along. But how about a really radical perspective on the problem? We'll hear one from Glenn Ford. While the 5 o'clock dim witness news was reporting on the teenager from South Windsor, the station almost certainly said nothing about a new report from a UN commission on torture. The UN criticized the United States government for torture and for failing to investigate torture and for failing to prosecute U.S. torturers. The radical thing here is that the UN commission considered the U.S.'s brutal police and brutal prison conditions to be a part of the government's torture system. And Glenn Ford entirely agrees. He spoke after the police killed Michael Brown in Ferguson and before the police killed Eric Garner in New York. Here is Glenn Ford.
Over the past 4 months, the world has come to know the name of Ferguson and rendered its own verdict on the U.S. criminal justice system. In addition to protests in nearly 200 American cities since the non-indictment of the cop that killed Michael Brown, demonstrations were staged in solidarity with U.S. blacks in at least 8 cities in Canada, as well as Japan, England, Scotland, and Norway. Last week, a United Nations committee registered its objections to U.S. treatment of blacks. The UN Committee Against Torture's latest report largely focused on the Obama administration's failure to punish the torture of detainees in places like Guantanamo Bay and in CIA interrogation sites around the world. But it also warned Washington that its policing policies in black America are not in compliance with international treaties against torture. The committee's findings are a great embarrassment to the planet's sole superpower, which justifies its military adventures around the world by virtue of its claims to moral exceptionalism. Based on 2 days of testimony by U.S. human rights activists last month in Geneva, Switzerland, the committee concluded that solitary confinement as practiced in the United States constitutes torture, that some conditions in U.S. prisons also fit the definition of torture, and that when police target African Americans on the street for abuse, beatings, tasering, and death by gunfire, they are guilty of torture. Moreover, if the United States does not provide remedies and compensation for the victims of torture at the hands of its cops and prison guards, then the nation is in violation of its international treaty obligations, which is legally the same thing as violating U.S. law. Not only does the U.S. fail to provide either remedies or compensation for those it tortures, U.S. law does not even define what torture is or set any standard to measure it, which shows conclusively that no American government has ever seriously considered doing away with torture, certainly not torture of black people. The UN committee was clearly quite impressed with a delegation of young activists from Chicago who testified under the banner "We Charge Genocide." The committee included much of the group's requests in its report, including investigation of police torture by outside institutions, prosecution of police who torture, and reparations for those who survive police torture in Chicago. The UN committee is most concerned that countries establish remedies to torture in all its deadly forms. But remedies are precisely what the United States refuses to offer to black people. No punishment for the cops, no compensation for their millions of victims, and no fundamental change in a system born in slavery and genocide. Under these circumstances, there is only one remedy: the overthrow of the system itself and the destruction, root and branch, of the mass black incarceration state, which must be the goal of this new movement in the making that still has no name other than Ferguson. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford.
One final footnote. In New York, police have arrested the man who shot the video of police choking Eric Garner to death. They also arrested the videographer's wife. Most of this program was recorded in December 2014. Here's a quick update. In December 2015, for incinerating 29 miners in Big Branch Mine, former Massey Energy executive Donald Blankenship was found guilty of one misdemeanor charge. He was fined $250,000 and sentenced to 1 year in jail. He began serving his sentence in April 2016. Thank you for listening to New World Notes. newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust. Illegitimi non carborundum. Please practice peace and nonviolence. And please come back again next week. Ciao.